You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, women tend to report higher stress levels compared to men. We'll find out why coming up.
First, as the opioid crisis continues to cause more overdoses and deaths around the country, children are often left feeling the traumatic impacts of neglect or of being removed from their parents' custody. Many end up living in foster care and moving from school to school.
That presents a lot of challenges when it comes to getting a normal education. A new project by the Huffington Post and the nonprofit education news service, the Hetchinger Project, looks at how schools and the foster system are handling those vulnerable students.
Caroline Preston is a senior editor at the Hetchinger Report. Caroline, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Rebecca Klein is an education reporter at the Huffington Post. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Caroline, let's start with you. Opioids, schools, the foster system. This is a pretty far-reaching series of reports. How did you and Rebecca decide to look into how these all interact and impact young people?
We were interested in looking at foster youth because their outcomes educationally tend to be quite poor. Only about 58% of young people in foster care graduate high school by age 19, whereas for the broader population, it's above 80%. And college graduation rates are, according to estimates, somewhere between 2 and 9%. So obviously those numbers are pretty discouraging, and we wanted to take a deeper look at what some of the specific challenges were and also what some potential solutions are.
And Rebecca, we talk a lot on the show, on the network, about rising trends in opioid overdoses, deaths, many of the impacts as a result of that. Can you give us a sense of how that epidemic is affecting where kids end up living and also where they end up going to school?
Sure. So overall, the foster care intake rate has increased around the country with some really drastic spikes in specific states like Indiana. When you're in the foster care system, it's more likely that you're going to switch schools based on where you're living. And when you switch schools, studies show that on average you lose about 4 to 6 months of learning every time. So it's really impacting their ability to get an education as they switch schools more frequently and as they are absent more often just due to the overall transitions and neglect and trauma they might be experiencing.
And are there commonalities about the schools where they end up when they get put in, say, foster placement that makes it even harder for them when they are trying to get a good education?
I think it really depends on where they are. Every state is different in terms of what happens when they go to school. But I would say in general, the commonalities are is that it's more difficult for them to succeed. They've experienced a lot of trauma, and school systems often, unfortunately, allow these students to fall through the cracks as they cycle in and out, and they have educators who aren't necessarily equipped to deal with the array of issues that they're coming to school with.
And Rebecca, can you take us into the classroom when children experience the neglect or trauma that comes with growing up around drug abuse? How does that manifest itself in the classroom with other children?
Sure. So I spent some time in a classroom in West Virginia where around half of the students weren't living with their biological parents. They were either living with foster parents or they were living with grandparents or family friends. And it was really difficult to get a child engaged on an educational level and get them to focus when they might be worried about where they're going to sleep at night, whether or not they're going to have food on the table, what might be happening with their biological parents who might be addicted or in jail. Overall, they just were less engaged than you might find in a typical classroom, and the teacher had to work just as hard, more hard to get them ready to learn.
And Caroline, tell us a little bit about that aspect of the crisis from the teacher's perspective. What are they needing to do in the classroom and outside the classroom to support their kids that really falls outside of the normal purview of being an educator?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was something that Rebecca found in West Virginia, is that teachers, I think she writes, just as much as sort of medical professionals and others are really kind of first responders to the opioid crisis. I spent some time in a school in the South Bronx that's focused on working with kids who are in foster care, whose families are receiving services to sort of keep them from having to enter foster care, as well as kids from a low-income community. And in that school, there were two teachers per classroom at the elementary level. There were sort of people on call who could deal with behavioral issues as they came up. And kids were, if they needed it, getting 30 minutes or more a week of mental health counseling. So that was sort of an effort to not have everything fall on the classroom teacher, but it is a lot and it is tough.
And Caroline, other than places like that school that you just referred to in the South Bronx, where they are intentionally creating a community for and with children in foster care, if it's a teacher who is not in a specialized program like that, but is dealing with and trying to help kids who are in foster care, who are in their class, are they getting the resources that they need to even know what they should be doing?
It's a big challenge. I remember writing a story from Cincinnati where there was a program started about a decade ago that sprung out of teachers having frustrations because kids, for example, were being pulled out of math class to have a meeting that their caseworker had arranged or to see a biological parent, and sometimes the kid would just kind of go missing and they weren't sure if the kid would be coming back. And in that sense, improved communication between the child welfare and the education systems was really key, and I think you're starting to slowly see that in other places as a result of federal legislation, education legislation that was passed in 2015 that's requiring those two agencies to collaborate more and to ideally stabilize kids in their schools and give teachers more support.
Rebecca Klein is an education reporter at the Huffington Post, and Caroline Preston is a senior editor at the Hechinger Report. We are talking about the intersection of the opioid crisis, foster care, and education in a recent series of articles that they produced. And Caroline, for kids who don't have relatives to live with after either the arrest or death of a parent or after they are taken away from a parent because of neglect or abuse, the foster care system is a likely destination. Can you tell us what happens when a child goes into non-family foster placement and has to continue their education somewhere else? What are the steps that happens to try to make that happen?
Well, there's been a real movement to place kids with families as opposed to in institutional settings, and then even ideally in kinship placements, so whether it's a grandparent or an aunt or something like that. But older kids do still end up in group settings, sometimes because they may have mental health or behavioral problems that make it challenging to place them with families in a more family-friendly setting, but also sometimes because there just aren't enough family placements. Some of those kids who are in those residential settings sometimes end up going to school on campuses. One thing we found is that those residential schools aren't really set up to have the same offerings as public schools, and academics kind of take a back seat to treatment and some other issues. So that's obviously a barrier. But I think, again, going back to the issue of stability, keeping kids, if they are placed with a family, hopefully they can stay with that family and stay in the school. If they do have to move, there's more of an effort now, again, with this federal legislation, to keep them in the same school by providing them transportation to go to the kind of their school of origin. But that's tough. And I think one thing we found with our reporting is that may not be happening to the extent that the legislation was meant for it to.
And Caroline, I want to go back to those residential facilities for a moment. Are these state or county-run facilities? Are they private? Who is running these residential facilities?
They're really a mix. Some are large for-profit contractors. Some are nonprofit large contractors. Some are small, religiously affiliated. We took a deep dive on the state of Pennsylvania, and they were registered under different parts of the state's code and varied quite a bit in sort of their size and approach.
And Rebecca, what kind of oversight is there? Is anyone paying attention to what's going on in these facilities?
Oversight is pretty relaxed. There's not a ton of accountability. So what you see is kids oftentimes being left to languish without the proper transparency or channels to get change.
We are talking with Caroline Preston and Rebecca Klein about their series of reports looking at how schools and the foster system are struggling to educate kids dealing with trauma, much of that fueled by the opioid crisis.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing this firsthand? If you're an educator, if you work in the schools, have you dealt with students who were affected by the opioid epidemic, maybe removed from homes, or dealing with parents who have dealt with overdose or incarceration because of opioids? How do you approach those situations? Or if this is something going on in your family, can you talk about your kids or grandkids or nephew or niece's story and how it's all working out for them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We're picking up our conversation with Caroline Preston of the Hechinger Report and Rebecca Klein from the Huffington Post, talking about how the education and foster care systems are responding to a rise in children dealing with trauma or neglect at home, often related to the opioid epidemic.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think could be done to better support kids who might have absent parents, whether it's services in school or something else? If you spent some of your childhood in foster care, did it make your education more challenging? And if you work in a school, have you seen the impacts of the opioid crisis on kids? When you know a student is dealing with trouble outside of school, what do you do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And Rebecca, are there resources that you got the sense teachers and administrators in regular schools really want that could help them better respond to kids dealing with trauma or who have been removed from their parents and are undergoing that separation?
The main thing I think teachers crave is information and collaboration with the social service agencies that are working with the kids. So sometimes they don't even receive all the information as to what might be happening in a child's life. So the child might be acting out in class. It might be clear that something's happening, but they don't know what, and therefore it's harder for them to serve this child and meet them where they are.
And Rebecca, it sounds like in some of these cases that you talked with the students or people in the schools, that the symptoms of trauma can actually be interpreted as a disability, and that can actually follow children and young people through their whole educational career and beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. So trauma sets you back tremendously, especially at that age when your brain is so malleable. So they might fall behind in school very quickly and then become stigmatized for a long time in their education career.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. Sarah in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am actually a caseworker in Milwaukee. I have been working as a caseworker for 2 years, and I am just so happy to hear discussion around this topic because, in fact, today I practice with a strong belief that relationships are kind of what these kids need, a strong sense of relationship in all aspects of case management. So these kiddos need to know that their caseworkers have a relationship with them. The caseworkers, I think it was already said, but that they need to have a relationship with the teachers and with the foster parents. And, in fact, just today I had a meeting with school professionals to talk about a kiddo who is experiencing some significant trauma. And you know what? We have an awesome game plan to ensure that this kid's going to come back to school and everybody knows where he's at and why, kind of how we're all going to support him. And I think that has been the key in ensuring that these kiddos get some stability, because you're right, the trauma that they're going through is just, it puts them back even further. So if we're all on the same page with positive relationships and positive intent, I think that's kind of where everything needs to go.
And Sarah, what happens when one of those pieces, it sounds like in this particular case, all the parts are working well together for the benefit of this child. What happens when one of those elements is missing or isn't on the same page?
I mean, a lot of times when one of those elements isn't on the same page, it's usually because of personal reasons. A foster parent doesn't want a kid to go home, or professionals have disagreements in kind of what's causing the behaviors or what needs to be the resolution. And I think at the end of the day, I think that at the end of the day, when all of these professionals are not on the same page or we're not communicating, it ultimately affects the ability to provide consistent and stable care for these kids. And we're as professionals showing these kids the positive relationships. And if we can't have positive relationships amongst our professionals when caring for this kid, how is this kid supposed to move forward and have a positive relationship with their foster parent, with their teachers, with their own parents, with their siblings, with their foster siblings? And I think it starts with the professional.
Sarah, thanks so much for that call. And Caroline, what Sarah was describing there reminds me of that school in New York that actually not just puts up with having foster kids, but embraces having foster kids and wants to help other kids not have to go into foster care through the school's efforts. What are those pieces that make that program so successful?
Well, both Rebecca and Sarah talked about information sharing and transparency. And one thing that comes to mind with that school in the South Bronx is that there's a lot of communication between the kids' caseworkers, the kids who are in foster care, and the teachers and the administrators. They even have a shared database. So if a kid is having a tough day, the teacher might go and look and see in that database, oh, the caseworker entered something about a difficult visit with that child's parent the night before, or something like that. So that can really help. I think they're also additional mental health supports like the counseling I mentioned earlier, and a real focus on social and emotional learning, being able to regulate one's emotions, communicate how you're feeling, take steps to try to mitigate bad feelings. Like for some kids, it might be having a specific stuffed animal. For others, it might be going and taking water breaks sometimes, or having a specific interventionist teacher who that kid is assigned to. So all of those things can help.
Thanks again for that call, Sarah. Let's go now to Marie in Green Bay. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I'm calling because this is a subject that is so complex. I have two kids in placement.
Good day.
Thank you. I have two kids in placement, and the Department of Social Services, the foster care system, I mean, it's just such a slow churning dynamic, and these kids seem to get lost in the middle of all the adults doing all the work around them. And I just want to say it's so important for that communication piece, because often when I have glitches with the kiddos that I have, it is usually because the adults are failing to communicate properly with each other.
Thanks for that call, Marie. And so Marie has two foster children in her care. And Caroline, one of the examples that you shared from that school in the South Bronx was a parent who so appreciated her children were still with her, and they were trying to keep her children with her. And she so appreciated the really hands-on direct communication that she got from the school.
Yes. I mean, in that case, that was a parent who was receiving preventive services, mental health counseling that's available through the city, through the city's child welfare agency to sort of help keep her family together. But she, you know, she worried that something might happen and she might lose her kids, but she felt like this school, more so than some other schools, was a really supportive environment that was committed to keeping her family together. And in one case, the school's director of social services, when this woman was having issues with her ex and her son went in and said, we have some domestic violence issues at home, the sort of school's director of social services even helped her stepped in and helped her get a court order against her ex. So it was, a supportive environment, like well beyond the walls of the classroom.
Rebecca, are there any instances of that really strong communication that creates a real safety net for these children that stands out to you from the people that you talked with?
Yeah, sure. There was one meeting that I sat in on, and it was a child. He was, I believe he was 8 at the time, and he was living not with his parents, not with his grandparents, but his great-grandparents. His parents and his grandparents were involved with drug use. So he was in a difficult situation. He didn't have someone there to wake him up in the morning because his great-grandfather, who was a primary caretaker, had to work in the morning, and he didn't have somebody putting him to bed at night. So he had a really hard time just kind of getting to school and being engaged when he got there. But he had his representative from the child welfare system coming and meeting with his teacher and school administrators regularly. And there was a lot of behavioral issues, as you could imagine, in the classroom. But every time they met, they came with a specific goal in mind, and they outlined a specific plan. They also kept in touch with, he had some medical issues, and so they were very on top of his physical health and trying to help the family be on top of that as well. And it's hard to say whether or not that's ultimately going to be an educational success, but without all of this collaboration, I think he would be in a much worse position.
Well, Rebecca and Caroline, thanks so much for joining us today and helping us sort through this really complex issue.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Klein is an education reporter at the Huffington Post, and Caroline Preston is a senior editor at the Hechinger Report. Their new series looks at schools, foster homes, and the opioid crisis, and that series is called Twice Abandoned.